I think that the big law firms thought, these are crazy radical students and they're going to graduate and go away. And I think what they've realized now is we're not crazy radical students. We are just people that are self-interested in having a habitable planet. And that energy is not going to go away.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. The Cross-Examination.
Hello, I'm Becky Anderson, and welcome to this episode of The Hearing, The Cross-Examination. In a recent Obelisk Support report, it was found that nearly three quarters of junior lawyers would not join an organisation if its values didn't match their own. And that remained true even if more money was being offered. Two-thirds of respondents said that firms should allow them to refuse to work on certain matters for ethical reasons. So with the groundswell of concern about the climate and what the medium to long-term future holds, it isn't really surprising that conversations about values are now starting to shake the legal profession. Early-stage career lawyers are approaching the profession, it seems to me, very differently to those of us that went before them. They are organising and responding to climate concerns in a different way. And I wanted to explore that with two people who are spearheading such responses.
The Cross-Examination.
Hi, my name is Haley Zarnick. I am the U.S. National Director for Law Students for Climate Accountability. I graduated from the University of Alabama School of Law last May, and I've been doing this work full-time ever since.
Hello, Haley. Thank you so much for coming on the show to talk to me. I have been watching the scorecard report that the Law Students for Climate Accountability have been putting out for some time. So I really wanted to start at the very beginning. And can you tell me and our listeners more about what Law Students for Climate Accountability are?
We got started in 2020 after there was a wave of protests against the law firm Paul Weiss for their representation at Exxon. Students at Yale, Harvard, NYU, and Michigan were protesting their recruitment events and asking them to drop Exxon. And what folks realized after they got a tremendous amount of attention is that if they didn't continue, that it was going to be just a day of headlines and nothing else. And so what happened was they decided that they wanted to figure out what other law firms were doing, right? They knew that Paul Weiss was representing Exxon, but they didn't know the other ways in which the legal industry was supporting the fossil fuel industry. And so they came up with the law firm Climate Change Scorecard, which was around October of 2020, I believe, that it was first published. And at that time, we weren't an organization. But when they saw the response to the first scorecard, they said, okay, again, we need to make sure that the energy doesn't die here. And so that's how we were born, was out of the first scorecard, the desire to keep that momentum going. And since then, we've continued to produce that scorecard annually. We've made minor adjustments over time, but the same structure and the same goals are still animating it. We want to give law students the information that they need to be able to use their labor power in ways that are consistent with their values, because we know that increasingly, people are understanding that this is about, you know, their water supply, their future, their children's futures.
Could you tell us a bit more about what the scorecard says? How does it score people on what metrics?
Sure. Yeah. So we're really laser focused on fossil fuels work because we know that firms already do a great job of talking about their in-office sustainability. They've all got pages on their websites that are going to share all of that information. But when it comes to their energy pages, you're likely to see a lot less clear information and a lot more euphemism. So you might see something to the effect of, we won a multi-million dollar judgment for a large multinational company. And just eliding, you know, the nature of that work. And so particularly for, let's say, a first-generation student like me, you might get really excited about the prospect of doing environmental law and not realize that you can be Chevron's environmental lawyer, right? And you still have to clarify which side of the V you're on. And so our scorecard is an attempt to quantify that work across three categories. We look at litigation, so the cases that are being brought in courts, transactions. So that is work that oftentimes really doesn't get seen at all because there's no one on the other side of the V. And so that's where you're drafting the contracts, arranging the financing. Otherwise, all of that stuff that happens before the pipeline is put in the ground or the project commences, mergers and acquisitions, all that kind of stuff. And we also look at lobbying. Now, when it comes to fossil fuels specifically, the Vault 100 law firms, which are some of the biggest law firms in the world, are the ones that we rank. And there's a number of those firms that are doing fossil fuel lobbying in addition to their other legal work. And that's to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. So I believe it was something like $35.5 million, somewhere around there, on this last scorecard, which looks at a five-year period. So this last one was 2018 to 2022. So those are the three categories. That's what we're looking at. It's the total value of the transactions that a firm is doing for the fossil fuel industry, as well as the sort of number of cases they're taking on and how much work they're putting in on those cases. We've got a proxy to look at how many filings they're doing to figure out the volume of work, and then just the straight compensation they're making on a federal level for lobbying for the fossil fuel industry.
And can I just very quickly ask you about what lobbying for the fossil fuel industry involves? Because that's something which I don't think we have it in the UK in the same way that you have it in the US. I don't think we have it in the EU in the same way that it happens in the US. So lobbying is not necessarily a huge revenue stream for European law firms. So what does that mean in this context?
In this context, it's specifically the ways in which the fossil fuel industry is using lobbyists, in this case lawyers, to talk to Congress on their behalf and try to prevent environmental regulations from going into place, try to weaken the ones that are going to go into place, try to put in favorable regulations or tax codes. So all of the different ways that you might try and use your money to influence the legislators to do what you want, to ensure that you're not going to have to face accountability, you're going to pay fewer taxes, you're going to be able to make the most amount of profit that you possibly can without regard to any of the consequences.
Hi, my name is Ming Zi. I am an associate in the Environment, Climate and Regulatory Group at Allen & Overy, and I'm also part of the Stewardship Committee and am the chair of Legal Voices for the Future.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk to me today. I have been hearing about Legal Voices for the Future, and I've seen some of your events popping up on my LinkedIn feed for some time now, but I really wanted to talk to you to get under the skin of Legal Voices for the Future. So can you start off by telling me, what is Legal Voices for the Future?
So Legal Voices for the Future, or I'm going to say LVF, Legal Voices, we are a collaborative knowledge sharing forum and also a networking forum established by junior lawyers, early career practitioners from different fields of law. Our aim is really to give voice to young lawyers on the most pressing issues of today, the climate, biodiversity and ecological crises. And we also want to educate young lawyers through a series of lectures and also enable young lawyers to really connect to their peers and build a sense of community around this, because it can be quite an isolating field and a daunting field to try and enter. We do monthly knowledge sessions, as we call them. Basically, these are sort of seminar style, but it's, you know, very collaborative, very community centered. And it's a presentation by an LVF member on a topic of their choice. Now, this topic is probably going to be related to climate law, ESG law, renewable energy, something around that sphere. And then they'll come and take in someone to interview. This could be someone with a more academic bent or someone in more senior positions of leadership on their relevant experience on the topic. And then there'll be a discussion around a related piece of creative content, so a book, a film or a podcast.
I just wanted to reflect a little bit, I think, on what you said about the knowledge sharing sessions, because I'm reminded very strongly of the Law Society's guidance on climate change, which really pinpointed a potential quite worrying, I think, skills gap in lawyers, particularly around climate. And it does feel from what you're saying that Legal Voices is something which for young lawyers, but potentially any lawyer, is really seeking to plug that skills gap quite comprehensively.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the main reasons, actually, why we came together and founded this group, because climate law, climate knowledge is not a compulsory subject in most legal curriculums. It's not covered on the BPTC. It's not covered on the LPC. I took it in university as an optional model in environmental law. And even within environmental law, climate change was only one out of nine subtopics. Where, you know, I think that's just insufficient and really doesn't communicate the relevant knowledge that our early career, you know, lawyers, practitioners need to be going into this new world, new industry where this is super relevant.
a message that we hear all the time is how grateful people are to have the community that is LSCA, because it's not really a conversation, at least in American law schools at all. You're not tested on environmental law on the bar exam. You have absolutely nothing, unless you've got a very cool professor who sort of incorporates it into their doctrinal courses, absolutely nothing that's going to come up in your first year courses. You're probably going to have limited electives even that you can take in your second and third year of law school. And so the amount of conversation that you're having as you're watching, let's say, a massive amount of Pakistan be underwater and millions of people having to be displaced, right? Or for me, in 2020, watching California, where I was born, experience tremendous amounts of wildfires. Mm-hmm. What are you supposed to do about that when there's no conversations to be had in the halls of power that you're currently occupying? And so that's something that we hear from a lot of folks, is how grateful they are to have a space where they can talk about these things that seem like really obvious truths that we just kind of elide throughout all of law school education for the most part.
So let's wind all the way back to the beginning. How did Legal Voices get started?
So it was really quite organic. Six of us friends slash colleagues, you know, acquaintances, we'd known each other from mutual professional networks. Someone was working at the government legal for environment. Someone was a climate barrister. A couple of us were in private practice doing various ESG or project finance related stuff. And we really just came together because we saw this need in legal education that needed to be filled. And then we also saw a lot of interest from peers, you know, other colleagues, juniors, junior associates, also students coming from law school who were looking for resources on ESG law, on climate law. And it was quite an informal process of, oh, you know, I was mentored by someone who came before me and was interested in ESG in my firm. And then she passed on the knowledge to me, and then I'm passing it on to other people. But then all of us thought, you know, why not form this group and get the necessary, you know, industry support to sort of become this platform and a community which can share these topics, these knowledge with each other and grow together. Because, you know, that's much more powerful than, you know, having it separate individual relationships. And I think we saw that there was that need there, and we just wanted to fill it.
How big is Legal Voices now? Because it seems to have grown quite quickly.
Massively quickly. We started January 2023, had our launch event, and we are at about 350 members counting. And we get around about between 50 to 100 people turn up at any of our knowledge sessions, which is, I think, very impressive given how young we are.
That's a very impressive turnout. I mean, that's an impressive turnout for any knowledge session, I would say, not just for early career lawyers. I'm very curious. I am not a lawyer at the start of my career. I've been doing this for a very long time. I'm curious how lawyers who are just starting out in their careers are looking at climate and the law and the intersection between the two.
We know that young people as a whole are more likely to understand that climate change is a big problem and to consider it when it comes to their career choices. And that's true when it comes to the legal industry as well. We think that this information has gotten such a big audience because people are really hungry for it, right? If people weren't interested in that information, then we would have never become an organization. There never would have been headlines in the first place. But people really want to know how their careers are going to ultimately contribute to the climate crisis.
You've put the scorecard out. You've ranked the law firms, I think it's A to F, according to how climate aligned or not they are. What feedback have you had? I mean, I should imagine there's some law firms who are pretty unhappy about that, but I'd also imagine that there might have been some law firms who've had some pretty pointy questions and are thinking about maybe they do need to make some changes. And I just wondered how much of that was sort of filtering back to you.
I think that the big law firms thought, these are crazy radical students and they're going to graduate and go away. And I think what they've realized now, as we're on our fourth iteration of the scorecard, is we're not crazy radical students. We are just people that are self-interested in having a habitable planet. And that energy is not going to go away. We're going to continue organizing as LSCA, and also folks are going to continue to care whether or not LSCA exists. And so we found that as we've put out new scorecards, we've gotten slight uptick in response each time. And so this past scorecard, we got the most responses from firms that we've gotten in the past. And that's not just A and B law firms, right? We have had conversations with those firms saying, this is awesome, we want to do even better. But we've also had conversations with folks at F firms who are saying, yeah, I know, and I want to do better, right? And sure, sometimes people are upset at us, but we always invite them to give us feedback, because if they can provide a compelling reason why we should alter our methodology, we will change it. There are times where we have made changes to either the way that we're doing our data collection or categorizing a particular case, for instance, if they see that we're super reasonable and we're willing to engage, and I really will talk to anybody, I don't care what grade your firm has, hopefully they will continue to want to talk with us later on. So that's what I would say is, if there's anyone listening that's angry, it's like, I don't think my firm should have this grade, which we have gotten on occasion, talk to us. We're perfectly happy to talk. If you think there's reasons why your firm shouldn't have the score that it has, or why there's something in our data set that is wrong, we want to hear that. There's a reason why we publish our data set, and it's because we want to do better, and we think transparency facilitates that. And so if you'd like to go look at it, it's always public, ls4ca.org. You can go to our scorecard page and see it. And the data set lives just under it. So you can see the scorecard, you can see the report with our methodology, and you can see the full data set.
I think a couple of years ago, maybe like 5 years ago plus, the idea of, you know, climate, biodiversity issues, they were pretty siloed from general law. Like, you know, you've got, you know, your other areas of commercial law, property law, tax law, and then you've got, oh, this little bit of environmental law. Like, you know, if you are a barrister, you're really interested in it, you go into like a planning set. If you're in commercial law, maybe you have to qualify into the environmental and regulatory practice. If you're in government, you want to go to, you know, DEFRA or the OEP. Now it's mainstreaming much, much more. When I sat in my first seat in leverage finance, there was even ESG components to some facilities, and I could work with one of the partners on, you know, developing precedents for sustainability-linked loans. Now that's something that I don't think I would have thought possible a couple of years ago, but you know, it's now there, and I wasn't even sitting in a particularly environmental seat. And I think you're seeing the same thing in, you know, pensions. There's a great overlap between pensions and ESG funds. There's, you know, the SFDR component that has become quite a hot topic. And so it's really mainstreamed. And I think this gives younger lawyers much more opportunity to be involved in this space. It's not an either or. You can have, you know, an ESG component, an environmental / biodiversity component in whatever area you choose to qualify into or specialize in. The caveat is that I think there is still an element of intentionality. Like, you do have to, you know, ask your supervisors, ask the partners for such work, you know, go to your clerks and sort of seek that out. But I think it's only going to become more and more relevant.
One of the things that I love about this, I suppose I shouldn't love it, because obviously we should already have this knowledge about climate change in us as lawyers. It should be baked into our practice already. But one of the things that I think I do love about this for early career lawyers is there are not years and years and decades of practitioners having done this. It's not like property law, where people have been practicing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. And when you have a 20 or 30 year practicing property lawyer, the knowledge and experience they've built up is incredible. I think this is an amazing opportunity for young lawyers to carve out a really impressive, effective niche for themselves really quickly, because they're not competing with people who've got 30 years of experience in that space, because it just doesn't exist. So I think that there's something really exciting there for young lawyers against the backdrop of something really awful, of course.
Yeah, super exciting. It allows you to push the boundaries and take so much responsibility in these work streams. I mean, I know within my firm, trainees are sort of taking the lead in whatever departments they're in and trying to push this stuff. So, you know, I've got a friend who sat in the capital market seat, and she's, you know, trying to do lots of green bonds, green derivatives, like helping her supervisor with know-how, you know, marketing BD efforts, and you know, this is really a new area that, it, you know, if you get in early, there's so much opportunity and so much growth and potential there.
And do you think that you're pushing on more of an open door now in trying to get that work, where previously it was so incredibly niche that A, a very small amount of people would be doing it, but B, you couldn't just walk into a mainstream transaction. You couldn't walk into a mergers and acquisitions and say, oh, well, where are the climate change questions in the due diligence piece? Because people would just look at you like
you're a weirdo.
You were in the wrong room. You were working for the wrong people. Do you feel that that's changing as a junior lawyer?
Yeah, definitely. I think climate ESG issues are on everyone's minds. All of the clients are cognizant of it, worried about it. And there's definitely much more room to bring it into the conversation.
The fact of the matter is that many, many people in these firms might not be ever touching a case for the fossil fuel industry, but that doesn't mean that they don't care to use their power as an employee at that firm to try and advocate to make change for within. And so that's what's been really interesting to me, is not just all of the students like myself who never wanted to go to a firm, right? That was just not the life for me. I knew that I couldn't hack it. I do not have the poker face to go practice in a court. And so I'm on the advocacy side, and that works quite well for me. But there's plenty of folks that do want to go do corporate law that don't want to also destroy their future while they're doing it, or don't want their firms to be complicit.
So what do you think is the duty of law firms in this regard, ethically speaking?
I will say that part of the reason that we exist is because we want to make sure, when it comes to law firms specifically, that they don't try and focus all of their efforts on in-office sustainability, right? Because if you're talking about scope 1 to 3 emissions, the emissions that are produced directly by your operations, for something like a construction company, that's huge. That's the biggest part of your emissions. That's what you need to focus on. For a law firm, what that could look like is creating a perfectly sustainable building that is used to help get pipelines in the ground, which is clearly not the world that we want to see, right? That's not going to get us where we need to be. And so a big part of my goal is to see if I can get into spaces where folks are having conversations about ESG or sustainability or corporate social responsibility, whatever framework that you want to use, and shift the narrative from, we want to use sustainable cutlery and plates, to let's stop doing fossil fuels work. And one thing that I think has become an increasing conversation is about this concept of advised emissions. So it's actually kind of unclear in scope 3 emissions if the emissions that we facilitate with our advice are included. And so rather than having that conversation about what are scope 3 emissions, is this part of this definition, folks are saying, leave that to the side, let's call them advised emissions, and let's figure out how we calculate them. And I think that's a really interesting conversation, and I'm really excited to see that framework come into existence. And that's something that I've seen firms jump on. However, I will say that we know that measuring is not the same thing as doing something about the numbers, right? And this is an incredibly complicated endeavor. There's so many different ways in which we provide advice. Is it the same amount of emissions if you provided services on litigation versus if you were working on transactions? Almost certainly not. But how do you decide that difference, right? If you're doing lobbying, probably you're facilitating quite a tremendous amount of emissions, but a lot of folks will say, well, you know, we were maybe helping them with a green energy project or something like that. And even then, how do you quantify that when you know that big oil companies are putting less than 3% of their assets into these projects? And many of the commitments that they have made, they very recently said, just kidding, we're actually going to double down our investments in fossil fuel infrastructure. This biomass, biofuels, carbon capture was never viable in the first place. And so we really want to see lawyers thinking critically about this and to shift that conversation. And so one thing that I say a lot is, you can decrease your advised emissions before you know how to measure them, because we already know that the single greatest source of our advised emissions is when we're providing advice for the fossil fuel industry. So if you stop doing that work, you're going to drastically cut those emissions. And the other thing is that you're also going to be able to provide more services to people who are on the other side of the V from the fossil fuel industry, right? There's a lot of things that you're going to be conflicted out. Or even if you're not conflicted out, you may not get a big oil client if you're representing a bunch of, let's say, renewable energy companies that they see as adverse to their interests, right? It may not be a literal conflict that would prevent you from taking on that case, but it may still practically prevent you from getting that client. And so there's a lot of those considerations that are going to prevent you from doing work that might be not only climate positive, but incredibly profitable. We know that there's a tremendous amount of resources, whether that's federally from the IRA or just in terms of like investments, right, that private actors are making. That's all money to be had if you put your services in that direction. So all that is to say, there's a lot of reasons why we should be focusing on the matters work that we do. And that's what I'm really trying to make happen. Because I think that without someone pushing that, without an organization like us, and let's say lawyers are responsible, a lot of other great folks, making sure that we're thinking about the work that we're doing, it's super easy for us to get lost in the weeds of quantifying things and making far down the road commitments that are pretty vague. And this is a very, not easy, but simple commitment that we want firms to make. Stop doing fossil fuels work, period, end of story.
One thing I wanted to put to you is that an argument I have heard from partners at big law firms is that if somebody else were to have advised on this deal, the emissions would have been worse. So we need to be the people who advise on that, because otherwise it would have been, if some other cowboy lawyer had done this work, it would have been a lot worse. And I wonder what sort of response that you had to that argument.
I find that pretty unpersuasive generally, as you can imagine. I think that it would be a tall order to really actually quantify that. But I will also say, this is a sort of thought experiment that I put to folks before. Imagine that instead of your big oil client coming to you as a firm for your services, that they were thinking about hiring you as in-house counsel. Would you go into that interview and say, "My goal is to help you move away from fossil fuels"? You probably wouldn't. And if that's the case, then they're probably using you as cover more so than they are using you to actually transition. And so maybe it's slightly besides the point of your question, but I think very often lawyers do convince themselves that the best thing I could possibly do is work for the fossil fuel industry and help them do just a little bit better. But the two things that I would say to that are, number one, realistically, I think if folks actually sort of collapse that cognitive dissonance and think about what the purpose is that this corporation has for hiring you, they understand that that's really not the thing, right? Even if they're hiring you for a green energy project, the vast majority of the time they're doing that, again, for greenwashing purposes, so they can continue to extract oil for longer. So to that extent, you're being used as a tool. And so the other thing I would say is, I just think we need to be, again, really, really critical about how we engage across the board with the fossil fuel industry.
On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform. A drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.
What do you think are the most exciting developments in climate and law that you're seeing right now? And again, I'm using law in a very broad sense here. You know, regulation, policy, litigation, but I'm also thinking about that wider sense of law, as in the legal practice, the advice that we give to people every day.
What a great question. So difficult to answer because there's, you know, as you know, the climate newsreel is just insane. It's nonstop. There's something new every week. And I'm like, oh, I didn't realize that judgment came out last week. Oh, I didn't realize the FCA published this the other week. What are the most exciting developments in climate and law? Because I'm a regulatory lawyer, I have to start with the regulation. And I think what excites me, it's reporting obligations and due diligence obligations. So, you know, it sounds very boring, but they're increasing in the depth, they're increasing in the granularity, and they're touching on, you know, explicitly human rights, environmental impacts, adverse impacts, and they're asking companies to, you know, not only identify these issues, but also, you know, mitigate and prevent these issues. Another thing I think is the litigation piece, including alternative dispute mechanisms. You know, there's an increasing use of human rights arguments and frameworks to challenge climate issues, and also, you know, claims at things like the OECD national contact point mechanisms, based off things like the UNGPs on business and human rights conduct, the OECD guidelines for multinational enterprises. That's a very interesting space to watch. And I think one more would be greater accountability. You know, I think we've seen a wave of greenwashing, but then following that, there are more and more frameworks and also regulatory enforcement of anti-greenwashing laws. The UK's Financial Conduct Authority just released their final policy on sustainability disclosure requirements, and they had an explicitly anti-greenwashing rule in there. You can also see, you know, the EU's Green Claims Code, the European Supervisory Authorities on the banks are looking at greenwashing risks. So a lot more, you know, accountability frameworks coming into place in response to the huge amount of environmental and ESG claims that, you know, we see in our financial products, in our day-to-day consumer products. And this is all very interesting to me.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. So for early career lawyers who are worried about climate, or indeed for any lawyer, early career or not, what questions should they be asking to clients, to their law firms, and what actions, practical, tangible things are available to them?
Two key questions. Number one, where am I best placed to make an impact? And number two, what are my priorities and what are my timescales? Number two is especially important if you are a junior lawyer. So for the first question, where am I best placed to impact? I think this splits into two. Number one, what kind of a lawyer am I? You know, what am I good at? Oh, am I like a finance lawyer, like a project lawyer? Do I want to go into renewable energy? Or am I more of a regulatory lawyer? You know, do I like the black letter? Do I like, you know, looking at lots of statute? And then the second sub question is, what are the systemic leverage points that I can tackle and want to tackle? So do you want to change the industry of law? Do you want to change clients via the law? Do you want to change society via legislation or litigation? So, you know, which area of law do you want to go into in order to make your impact? And that's almost like a, you know, a choice between you want to be a commercial solicitor, in-house, NGO, barrister, you know how lawyer, whatever. And then for the second question, what are your priorities and what are your timescales? So is salary, financial rewards a priority for you? It very well might be. Is influence important? Is making an impact important? Learning opportunities, the flexibility for your future career path. Now, you know, all of these are things that you might want to pursue, but you might not be able to pursue at the same time. So the question is then, when do you want to pursue? Do you want to prioritize now your learning opportunities and then you can make your impact and influence later on? Do you want to prioritize your salary now, or are you fine to defer that to a later stage? Are you pretty clear on your career path, or do you still want to maintain that, you know, open flexibility? So those are very personal questions you need to ask yourself. But I found that a very good framework to think about when I was making my choices as a young lawyer.
You absolutely don't have to be a climate litigator to make sure that you're having a positive impact on the climate. There are so many different ways in which you can advocate from the position that you're in right now. And that's one of the messages that we want to share to folks, that you actually do have power. And if you look for them, you have allies, right? There are people inside your massive firms that also care about, you know, again, having a water supply, right? This is not some far off, crazy radical thing. We used to talk about it being sort of like, well, don't you want your grandkids to have a good life? And it's not an our grandkids problem anymore. It's an us problem. And so I think people are increasingly realizing that. And you're going to find that if you look for them, you will find other folks that are interested in moving your firm in a positive direction. And so I think a couple of concrete actions that folks can take. If you are in the interviewing process, that is the absolute best point in time where you can utilize your power. ask questions about their fossil fuels work. And you do not have to be adversarial about it, right? If you're like, I really actually need this job and I can't risk my interview going poorly, there are plenty of ways that you can ask that question that shows that you are thoughtful and caring and really want to hear their answers. That isn't, you know, are you going to stop doing your fossil fuels work tomorrow? Because if not, I'm not coming here, right? Mm-hmm. Now, would I love to say that to a firm? Sure, but you don't have to, right? There's plenty of ways you can ask that question. And so that would be my first piece of advice is you have a tremendous amount of power in the interviewing process because you are their most valuable asset. There is a reason why they wine and dine summer associates, and that's because you are their talent pool. You are very, very valuable to them. So I think those questions in interviews are incredibly powerful, but it doesn't stop in the interview. For instance, you might ask questions in your orientation about how clients are selected, and you can probably get just a little bit more pointed there, right? You've already got the job. But then you can also start to raise those questions throughout the course of your career, right? Ask partners, ask your peers, figure out who's doing good work within the firm, right? If you're like, I don't know if I can go talk to this person because that might be damaging, go find the people that are on the ESG committee. Go find the people that are doing the renewables work. Those are going to be people that more than likely are doing that work because they care and are aligned with you. And so go talk to them about who's making the decisions in the firm. What is the fossil fuels work that you're doing? What are the developments that they're seeing? And figure out if you can work together with them to make change internally.
I think what I love about that answer is that whilst that 100% applies to early career lawyers, actually it applies to lawyers at any stage of their career. If you are interviewing to move firm, you can ask those questions. If you are, if you have some expertise in one area, there's no reason you can't start looking to develop a second set of expertise in a more climate aligned area. You know, if you are on the partnership track, there is no reason that you can't start asking those questions and making those sorts of decisions all the way up your career. You can start now, no matter how many years qualified you are.
Absolutely.
You should find mentors, you know, someone whose work you want to be doing, or if that work you want to be doing doesn't yet exist, find someone whose work is adjacent to that or who can help you get those clients and get that kind of work.
And the other thing that I will say is, advocating for renewables work and for work that might be adverse to some of these big oil clients or fossil fuel clients is also positive, right? Because you could start conflicting your firm out of some of those cases. And I think that's fabulous too, right? So lots of different ways that you can try and move your firm in the right direction.
What can you do now? I think one thing is to join Legal Voices and our community. Follow us on LinkedIn, sign up to watch and attend our events.
And if you are still scared and feeling like you don't know what to do, I would invite you to email us and we would happily hop on a Zoom and workshop it with you and talk through how you can use your power to be part of the solution.
And then I think the final action that I would say is actually just take care of yourself, because this isn't a sprint, it's a marathon, and we will be dealing with this problem for the rest of our lives. I think it's very good to feel a sense of worry and urgency, and it's very prevalent in our industry, but it's important to find, you know, oases of relief, ways to nourish ourselves and keep on going. And, you know, this can be completely non-climate related. I mean, for me, it's in art and in music. And I think you need to find that oasis for yourself as well in order to make this a sustainable thing for you. You know, pun unsustainable. Sustainability has many meanings, and this can be one meaning.
Is there anything else that you would like to say before we close this?
The only thing I would say is that it's a really exciting, interesting space. The people are amazing. I mean, the people that I've met just through Legal Voices alone have been incredible. There's so much talent, enthusiasm, and drive, you know, in spite of, you know, all of the doom and gloom and anxiety and worry that you hear on the newsreel every day. The people are so incredible, so good at what they do, and also just genuinely nice humans. I think definitely get involved however you can, whether it's through, you know, pro bono, whether you want to make climate, ESG, biodiversity issues, you know, the core of your career, or if it's just something that you want to do as part of a broader practice, whatever you do, just get stuck in and you'll find that it's so rewarding and you won't regret it.
I think I would add to that, and I would say there are so few areas in the law where there is the possibility for genuine innovation. We're not a profession or a practice that does a lot of huge and genuine innovation. We're a practice which is built up on centuries of case law and regulation and checking copies of Hansard to see what people actually meant when they put some regulation in place and all of that sort of thing. And here is a space, I think, particularly exciting because there's the genuine opportunity to be innovative as a lawyer. So if that is something which speaks to you early in your career, then I think that there is a chance here for you that didn't really exist for my generation when we were starting out. And I think that's terribly exciting.
Absolutely.
The physical world is already changing due to climate crisis. We know this, but it is so interesting to me to look at how this is changing people and changing culture. The legal profession is not particularly known for being fast-moving and innovative, and yet even here, shifts are happening, and I'm excited to see what comes next. Thank you so much to my guests for talking to me today. I've been Becky Annison, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, then please do like and subscribe for more content, or email us on thehearing@thomsonreuters.com and tell us what you thought. Goodbye.
The Hearing. The Cross-Examination. A legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.